All right, well, we are going to start this time together with a Calvary Baptist poll, all right? By show of hands, how many of you believe that I have a tattoo? And don't look to my family members, they're not going to vote. So hands up if you believe that I have a tattoo. Okay, a few of you. I'll let you know in a moment. Lots of people have tattoos, right? Some people get them for foolish reasons. Other people get them for important reasons. I was an x-ray tech for over 20 years. I have seen a whole lot of naked bodies, and I see what people tattoo on themselves. And I would say that the thing that people mostly put on their bodies is the commemorative tattoo. So, you know, they've lost a loved one, so there's a name or a picture. Or a whole lot of pets are tattooed on people's bodies. Now, another thing people like to tattoo on their bodies is something that is symbolic of their faith. Years ago, when I was teaching Sunday school, we were learning about the verse, Isaiah 40, 31. And that verse says that those who hope in the Lord, they put their hope in the Lord, they will renew their strength. They will soar with wings like eagles. And so I told the kids, do you know that Mrs. So-and-so has that tattooed on her body with a big eagle? Now, what I didn't tell the kids was it was down on her lower back. And she's a really good friend of mine, but she gave me grief about that for years because after church, all these kids came running to her and said, please, show us your tattoo. Now, there's a young man in our church, his name's Tom, and he's getting a whole sleeve done. And at the top is going to be the lion and the lamb. And down here is a dove and a raven, and they're fighting, but the dove is winning. And then on his forearm, there's a picture of a boy. And he's holding the hand of somebody, but you can't see that person. And the message of this tattoo is that God triumphs over evil. And Tom is walking away from evil, being led by Jesus. And the truth of this message is so overwhelmingly true and important to Tom, he is permanently putting this on his body. And because it's on his body, he's actually going to see the truth of it every single day. Today, we're going to continue in our series on the book of Joshua. It's called A People Moving Forward. We're going to hear about a great thing that God did for the people and what they did to remember that. And if you'd like some more context of where we are in the book of Joshua, I would encourage you to read the first couple chapters or listen to the last couple of sermons. But today we are in Joshua chapters 3 and 4. That's page 208 in your Pew Bibles, or you can look it up in your app. And while you do that, I will tell you that I do not have any tattoos, nor do I plan on it. But but I appreciate the people who raised their hands. little bit of street cred. All right. Joshua chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Shittim and went to the Jordan, where they camped before crossing over. After 3 days, the officers went throughout the camp, giving orders to the people. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God and the Levitical priest carrying it, you are to move out from your positions and follow it. Then you will know which way to go, since you have never been this way before. But keep a distance of about 2,000 cubits, that's about a kilometer, between you and the Ark. Do not go near it. Joshua told the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on ahead of the people. So they took it up and went ahead of them. So verse 4 says, you've never been this way before. God, or as the people called him, Yahweh, we learned that last week, that is the Hebrew name for God, he was going to take them somewhere that they had never been before. And they had been waiting 40 years for this. A lot of the people were 60 years old. Joshua and Caleb were 80 years old. And so there was a great anticipation among them. Now, during this time, The presence of God was in the ark, and there should be a picture on the slide above me, a picture of the ark. And this is where God chose to reveal his presence to the people. Now, we know from the Bible that the ark was with them in the desert years. It was with them in the land of Canaan during the time of Joshua and the book of Judges. And it was also with them during the time of the kings, right? King Solomon kept the ark in the temple. But then the Babylonians came and they conquered the Israelites, they exiled them, and we no longer at that point have any evidence of its existence. The ark has vanished from history. Except, of course, when Indiana Jones had to find it before the Nazis did. Now, there was three things in the ark. Who can tell me what they were? The tablets, right? So the tablets. What's the other thing? Manna. And what's the third thing? Not incense. Aaron's staff. That's right. So there was three things in the ark. The first were the tablets. So when Moses went up Mount Sinai and God gave him the law, which included the Ten Commandments, there was many others as well. So the tablets went in the ark. Then there was the manna. This was the food source that God gave them when they were in the desert for 40 years. And so they would find it every morning on the floor of the desert. This was a visible reminder of God's faithfulness to them every day in the desert. And they would collect it and they would make bread from it. And so some of the manna was put in a golden pot, and that was in the ark. Now the third thing that was in the ark was Aaron's budded staff. In that time, God set up the worship the way he wanted it. He took Moses' brother Aaron, and Aaron was to be the high priest. And all priests were just to come from the descendants of Aaron. And there's a story in Numbers 16 and 17 where it talks about that the people are grumbling. And they come to Moses and Aaron, and they're like, why do you guys get to be in charge of everything? And so God sets out to give them a visible lesson. He's like, okay, this is what I want you to do. There was 12 tribes, and each tribe was to take their staff. Now, a staff wasn't really a walking stick. It was more of a status symbol of who was in charge of the tribe. It would even have their names engraved in it. And God said, I want all 12 tribe leaders to take their staffs and put it down in front of the ark. And then Aaron, you take your staff, and you lay it down with them. And in the morning, whichever one of these staffs sprouts new growth, that is who the high priest is. So this is exactly what they did. And in the morning, not only did Aaron's staff have leaves on it, it actually produced almonds. I mean, God just didn't want to allow for any doubt. So Aaron was proven of his appointment to be the high priest. The dissenters were quieted, and then the rod of Aaron was put in the ark. God said, put it in the ark. I want it always to be a visible reminder of the authority that I have given to Aaron and his descendants. You know, I hope you take time to read the Old Testament stories, because you might read them and you're like, what does this have to do with my life? Or I don't see Jesus in here at all. But in so much of the Old Testament, it points to Jesus. And that's what makes it so interesting to study. You see, Jesus is the fulfillment of everything that's in the ark. The tablets with the law were in the ark. Well, Matthew 5:17 says that Jesus came to fulfill the law. The manna, the bread the people ate in the desert was in the ark. John 6:35, Jesus says, I'm the bread of life. Come to me, you'll never be hungry again. And then Aaron's staff was in the ark because it was evidence of Aaron's authority as high priest. Well, Hebrews 4:14-16 says, Jesus is our high priest. And so the Israelites' rejection of Aaron is symbolic of humans' ongoing rejection of Christ, right? The Son of God had to humble himself and come to earth and live as a human. And Aaron also had to humble himself. He had to go and take his rod and go place it with the others. And on that day, God vindicated Aaron by bringing new life to a dead stick. And God vindicated Jesus by resurrecting his dead body. Lastly, the covering of the ark was called the mercy seat. And there was a couple of cherubim, kind of angelic-like creatures on top. And there was the mercy seat. And once a year on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would sprinkle blood on the mercy seat. And this was to make up for the punishment. It was the punishment of the sins of the people. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. Well, this also points to Jesus, right? The punishment for sins is death. And mercy is not getting what we deserve. And so with Aaron as high priest, he would slaughter an animal, and the animal would be sacrificed for the sins of the people. But Jesus is our high priest. And who did he sacrifice? He sacrificed himself for us. You see, when we read both the Old Testament and the New Testament together, we can see this incredible continuity of God's story in our lives. Now, in verse 5, Joshua tells the people, consecrate yourselves, which means prepare yourselves, get ready. There were other times on their journey that God did this. They were to consecrate themselves before Moses and the people met God at Mount Sinai, and God was going to speak to them. They were to consecrate themselves when they were complaining about the manna, and God said, okay, I'm going to send you some meat, but get yourself ready. Consecrate yourselves. And so what this usually meant for them, or part of the process, was that they would wash their clothes, they would abstain from sexual relations, they would confess their sins. So basically, they were getting themselves cleaned up on the inside and the out. They were getting ready, and they were preparing for God to act. So I want to continue reading verse 7. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river. Joshua said to the Israelites, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. And as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. Yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan. While the water flowing down to the sea of Arba, that is the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stopped in the middle of the Jordan and stood on dry ground while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. Continuing into chapter 4, when the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priests are standing, and carry them over with you, and put them down at the place where you stay tonight. The people were moving forward, but there was this water barrier. And so God was wanting them to step out in an act of faith. He was going to go first in the ark, and he told the priest to take the ark just to the edge of the water. And they were standing on the edge, and this, they really had to depend on God's mercy. Because the moment they stepped into the water, they could have been swept away. I think this is why God really wants to lead us places we've never been before. Because when we are in a position of utter helplessness, that's when we truly have to depend on God, right? Psalm 121 says, "Where does my help come from? It comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth." Now, there's a map above you, and we've seen this map before. It shows you the Jordan River, which flowed from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. And the author of this text, who is Joshua, he takes a moment in the story to share with us that it's the springtime, it's flood time. Well, why is that important? Well, normally the Jordan River is about a mile wide, but during the flood times in the spring, its banks broaden to 3 to 14 miles. And the drop in elevation coming down to the Dead Sea is 40 feet per mile. So this was not some quiet stream. This was a raging river. And so Joshua shares this with us because he really wants us to understand the miracle that happened here. This was not a stream that they're going to get across just if, you know, if they're careful and they have a good strategy. The only way they're going to get across is with the divine intervention of God. And so the author wants us to know the impossible task that's ahead of them. And I want you to take a look at verse 17, the last couple of words there. It says that they crossed over on the dry ground. So just the fact that the river parted and was dammed up on either side, that's an incredible miracle. But you would expect the ground to be muddy, wouldn't you? But the ground was dry. God goes big with his big axe, right? Go big or go home. It was just an utter and complete miracle. And so now they're on the other side. And God had said that each of the tribal leaders, 12 of them, were to get a big stone and they were to make a memorial. And you'll notice it doesn't say 9.5 tribes, it says 12. Because we learned a couple of weeks ago that the tribes of Reuben and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh, they were actually going to settle in on the east side of the river. But they made the commitment that they would help all the other tribes get over to the west side. And so that's why all 12 tribes are represented here, because they're working together. Let's read a few more verses. Chapter 4, verse 4. So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, "Go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever." Life can get pretty busy for most of us. And when life gets busy, we tend to forget things. So I use a day timer. I thought it was pretty funny. Not so long ago, I was in my office with one of the staff members, and somebody popped in and said, "Oh, hey, Michelle, can we get together at such and such time?" And I just instantly went and wrote that in my day timer. And the staff member's like, "Wow, that's how you remember everything." Or after the service, I always have my phone with me in my hand. And it's not because I can't be separated from my phone. It's just I know that if I'm talking with people, if I write down right away what they'd like me to do or where we're going to meet, then I'm not going to forget. And names are so important to remember, right? Yay for Name Tag Sunday. And names are important. And I know that because every time I get one of the children's names wrong here at the church, they get indignant with me. That's not my name. And so I was just like, well, you can call me Melissa. And, you know, that tends to bring a smile to their face. Every November, we wear poppies. Why? To remember what happened 100 years ago. And we talk about it in our homes, and we teach it in the schools, because if we don't, the children who have really had no contact with World War I or Armistice Day, they are not going to remember. So we continue to teach the next generation. Well, our forgetfulness can also be damaging to our faith. You know, for those of us who are Christ followers, God's greatest act of love and power was demonstrated to us 2,000 years ago. How are we going to remember that? Right? In God's great love, he sent his son to die for us. In God's great power, he raised Jesus from the dead. So what are we going to do? What are we already doing to help ourselves remember what happened over 2,000 years ago? Well, as individuals, you know, sometimes the story of Christ's death and resurrection can lose its wow factor a bit, right? Because we've heard the story so many times. So try telling that story to somebody else. You know, I always find that when I'm sharing with somebody who's a different faith background, or maybe they've never gone to any kind of church growing up, that when I'm sharing the good news about Jesus and what he's done, they get excited or they have really good questions. They're curious. And that tends to excite me again, right? When I hear the words come out of my mouth, when I start sharing about Jesus, I'm reminded of God's goodness to me, and it's exciting again. Visual reminders are a great idea. I mean, that's what God did, so it must be a good idea, right? And so what is in your home or your room or your car that can act as a visual reminder of what, you know, of God's love for you? Gilgal was the name of the town where they built the memorial. Well, there probably wasn't a town there at that point, but it was called Gilgal. That was the area. And eventually that became like a real outpost for the Israelites. And so they were going to be returning to this area many times. And so that's why they put the memorial there, because they knew that every time they came back to that spot, the Israelites would see the 12 stones and they go, yes, this is the spot. This is the place that God helped us cross the Jordan River. And so what can we use as reminders in our day? Things that we keep coming back to. I know I've shared this in the past, but, you know, Dave Barker says he's got on his phone. When he wakes up in the morning, there's a prompt. It says, have you talked to God before you talk to anybody else? Other people use the clock, and they'll pick a point on the clock where they'll just take 1 minute every hour just to sit and reflect on who God is and how much God loves them. You know what? Even when you're breathing in and out, that's a reminder of God, because every breath you take comes from God. Our very next breath comes from God. If God didn't want you to be here, you wouldn't have your very next breath. And so whether you're just finishing a run, or you've plopped down on the couch to watch TV, or you're taking a break at work or school, just our breath in and out reminds us that we're alive, because God's alive, because he wants us here. You don't have to tattoo yourself to prove that that you love Jesus. But God says, fix my words in your hearts and minds. So these are things that we can do every day of the week. But what do we do on Sundays? You know, that day where we come and we have our public worship of God. The Israelites were told to consecrate themselves. And so there was this fervency to it. They're like, oh, we need to do it. God's going to act today. And they would come together and they would wake up in the morning with their praises to God first thing on their mind. They'd confess their sins. They'd make things right with other people. They were expecting God to act. But let's be honest. For many of us on a Sunday morning, the only prep we do is, should I go to church today or not? And then when we come, there really isn't an expectancy that God is going to lead us anywhere that we haven't been before. We want God to do great things, don't we? And we know when those great things happen, it's only God who can do it, but we have a part to play. And our part is to prepare. So those are a few things we can do as individuals, but what about as a church family? You know, what do we do as a church family to remember the good things, the great acts of God for us? When I was little, my mom was always one of the people that cleaned up after communion. And so my brother and I's jobs was to run in the pews and collect all the little plastic cups. And there was always like a drop of grape juice in the bottom of each cup. And so we would drink it because, you know, Welch's grape juice tastes really good. And when my mom found that out, she was horrified for a couple of different reasons. But then she sat us down and she explained to us what the cup and what the bread meant. Because in the church I grew up, children didn't partake in communion. Now at Calvary, we like to have family communion every few months. The next one is at the beginning of June. And parents know whether their children are ready to participate or not. But whether the children participate or whether they just observe, they get to witness something that has been practiced for 2,000 years as a reminder of what Jesus has done for us. And so each generation does it so that they can teach the next generation. And so while the children are in the service, they can say to their parents, what does the Lord's Supper mean? You know, Joshua told them to set up this memorial because it was for this generation, it was for the next generation. And if you look at the very last verse, verse 24 of chapter 4, he said it is for all the peoples of the earth, so that they will know the Lord and what he has done. Another thing that we can do as a church family to remember the things that God has done for us is to pray together. You know, in the New Testament church, they would come together and maybe one or two people would do the teaching, but everybody would sing, right? Everybody would pray. There wasn't just one person praying. And there's a wonderful story about Peter. Peter was in prison, and the church had gathered, and they were praying for Peter. And an angel comes to Peter, frees him from prison, and then Peter goes to the church, and he bangs on the door, hey, let me in. And they're like, who is it? They didn't believe it was Peter, even though they were gathered together, and they were praying for Peter's release, right? There's such a power in when we come together and we pray together. We get to hear what's going on in each other's lives. This is what God has done in my life. And we get to pray corporately for the things going on in our own congregation, but also for our city and for our world. And so that's how we are going to end our time together. We're going to pray together. And I'm going to invite all of us to pray. And you know, over the last few weeks, when I've been just praying with one person, they've said to me, oh, I'm not very good at praying. And I took the time to explain to them that that's not a real thing. Everybody's good at praying, because praying is just talking to God. Think about it like when you have Christmas dinner and all the family's there, and you're not worried about what you're saying. In fact, it's hard to get a word in, you know, edgewise, because everybody's talking at the same time. That's what God wants it to be like here, that we're just a family. Don't worry about being eloquent or saying the right thing or going on and on. If you've got something on your heart that you want to share in prayer, that's what we're going to do together. So that's what we're going to do right now. One of the things I would invite you to do is to stand and use a big voice, because it's wonderful if you pray, but it's even better if we can all hear you. So let's do that. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have given us so many good things to remember you by. And the most important is how your Son came to earth, humbled himself, died for us, and then you rose him from the dead, and we thank you for that. I thank you that you bring us together into community. We are the church. And I thank you for the story of how Peter was freed from prison when the church was gathered to pray for him. And I ask that you will just remind us that that's what we're supposed to be doing, praying together. And so, Lord, we just come before you right now as your sons and daughters. We're not going to worry about what words we say. We just want to share our hearts with you now.